Okay, welcome to the Stage Shift Podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young artists entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of those behind the success. So go to thestageshiftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the recording, writing and performing processes with members of Radiohead, The Stone Roses, Supergrass, The Lathams, The 1975, Gorillaz, Oasis, Chic, Jungle, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Guns N' Roses, Jefflin's Ear, and Kraftwerk. Today we're joined by songsmith Andrew Christian to discuss his new album Love Is For Everyone. Andrew garnered recognition as being one of the finest young songwriters of his time, and was one of the first people to be taken under his wing by Noel Gallagher, who shaped, produced and played on Andrew's song Where's My Family Gone. Today we'll be asking Andrew, when is a song finished? What percentage of your songs do you listen back to and wish you could make a slight change to? How do you decide what key to write in? How to maintain a positive working relationship with session musicians, and exploring the topic of internal versus external validation as artists. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Shift Podcast is none other than Andrew Christian. Thanks for joining us today, Andrew. How's it going?
I'm fine, mate. How are you?
Yeah, going good. So listen, we're recording this on the eve of your release of your new record. When it's a few weeks out before a new record, what are the emotions that you're feeling right now before people have heard more than just two tracks?
It's a different feeling this one than it was for the first record. First one, it was all really new and all that kind of stuff. This is a little... I've been at this point before, do you know what I mean? We're trying to do things differently. We didn't do as many in-stores and out-stores and stuff on the last record as what I wanted to. So I don't know, I suppose we're just trying to right the wrongs of how we approached the last record. I don't think there was anything that was particularly wrong with how we approached it, but just not trying to leave any stone overturned, whatever the fucking phrase
is. Yeah.
We're just trying to do that. So we're trying to do more in stores. So it's funny because we've worked on this campaign of promoting the album, but the real work comes when it's like 2-3 weeks to go, because that's when you start doing all of the in stores and the signings and as many interviews as you can, and you know, all the content and stuff every day. So that's when the real work starts, when it's like 2-3 weeks away. But I'm excited, man. I believe in the record. I believe in the new tunes. The two singles that we've released, everyone seems to be really into them, so hopefully it's a good sign for what's to come.
And you talked about reflecting on the first process of the first record and comparing it to this one. What was the blueprint for this record? So was there anything you wanted to do more of or less of in regards to the actual recording?
I was really conscious to not make it quite dour and maudlin. I was really conscious about doing that. You know, the first album, I've spoke quite openly about it, but the songs on the first album, they were all very, you know, self-reflective of the things that I've been through, you know. Yeah, so the songs on the first record, they were really self-reflective of what I'd been through and what I was going through. So naturally, they were going to be quite maudlin and, you know, very much about me, do you know what I mean? Whereas this second record, I was very conscious that I wanted to go in and I wanted to make something that was upbeat and something that could relate to everybody. So there's a lot of talk of love in there. You know, everybody falls in love, everyone falls out of love. So I wanted to write something that was for everybody, really. And then obviously the title Love Is For Everyone, it becomes quite self-explanatory that it's kind of what the themes of the record is. But it's all really quite upbeat, man. And I was really, you know, every song, even the acoustic stuff that I went in with, you know, it was always a way of how can we make this, you know, where somebody can jump around to it a little bit more. And I think we've achieved it, man. There's a really, really good balance on the record of, you know, more Oasis-y rock, and, you know, quite a decent bit of almost fucking Wombat style indie.
Nice.
And then there's also the classic stuff that I've been doing for the last few years as well. So I think we've ticked every box on the record anyway.
Have you started rehearsals yet for playing those two songs live?
We start rehearsals in April. My MD is planning the set at the minute. Obviously, we'll work out all the tunes and all that kind of stuff. Everything's in the years now, isn't it? So it's not like the old days. It's not even like 5 years ago when I first started gigging. It's like, it's so easy now. Everyone's got in their headphones, you know, guitar solo in 3, 2, 1. It's like, it's impossible to get wrong. So we're just waiting for that to come through. But we start in April. If you can hear any barking, by the way, that's my two pugs. Looks like hello to him.
Question for you: what's the relationship between you and the musical director? You just mentioned the MD there, because we have a lot of, you know, the reason the podcast is called Stage Left is we speak to a lot of people who are also like session musicians and people who are not necessarily the front person of a band. And it's always interesting to, in fact, I'm interviewing someone this afternoon who's the MD for Selena Gomez, and I'm actually going to ask him, which I'm going to ask you, but from a different perspective, which is, what is that dynamic between that relationship? Is the MD there to fulfill your creative vision, and who has that particular kind of finalized decision over how that relationship works? It's kind of an interesting one.
Well, I'm very lucky because he plays in my band as well. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if I don't like someone if I don't like something about the set, there's nowhere for me to hide. And added to that, if I've messed something up, there's nowhere for me to hide. It's just trust, I think. I think you've got to have so much trust. Obviously, I'm trusting them with my songs. I'm trusting them with the things that I've created. They're my bends, really. Do you know what I mean? All my songs are like my bends. So you obviously want to do them all justice. So I always trust him with that. He knows that if there's anything that he's a little bit, I don't know about that, he always comes to me and rings us and we have a chat about it and all that kind of stuff. Planning the set, it's a little bit of give or take. I'll give you an example. We used to finish the set with Where's My Family Gone, which was what the song we'd done with Noel. And before we went back to America last year, so we'd done the Louis Tomlinson tour the year before, so we knew the people that were coming to the gigs. You know, they're incredible fans, are really loud and all that kind of stuff. So he went, well, why don't we try and put War Flags last, because it finishes with that la la la. And I was massively against it. And he said, no, but we want to create something where, you know, as people are leaving the venue, they're still going la la la. Do you know what I mean? And it was just having that trust. And I just said, yeah, do you know what? We'll do it. And do you know how many people sang la 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 when they left the venue? Not fucking one.
So there you go.
Until I think the last gig of the year, last year, we were in Cologne and we were sat in the dressing room. This is no word of a lie. I was sat in the dressing room with a big bottle of wine. It was the end of the Waiting for the Rain campaign. We toured it for 2 years. And we went like that. And you just said, la, 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 all the way around the street. And everybody was singing it. And we all had a good laugh anyway. Fucking hell. That's the kind of rock and roll we get up to, listening to people sing la, la, la outside of a dressing room.
Now, 99% of musicians listening to this would want to be in your shoes, right? So you've written songs that when you first wrote them, so, you know, previous to your last, you know, your first record, you had no idea if anybody was really going to ever sing along to these or it was going to take off. Now, fast forward to writing your second album, you definitely know whatever comes out of your mouth or whatever chord progression you choose to write, there are going to be people singing that back at you. How did you lean into that or lean away from that, subconsciously or consciously, knowing that people are going to be expecting something from you and singing along to it?
Yeah, but it's a funny one because, first and foremost, it's never something that, it's not something that anybody thinks is going to happen anyway, but it was never something that I actually really thought about. I didn't really think about going into music and wanting to be a singer, wanting to be a musician. I wrote those songs for me because I was feeling bad at the time, and that was my therapist, right? And I've spoken quite openly about it. I lost someone really, really close to us in my life, and it was either go and speak to somebody, like a professional, or pick up that guitar and pour your heart into it, and that's all I'd done it for. So everything that I was writing on that guitar, I wasn't writing it. I never wrote Where's My Family Gone thinking, I can't wait to get out on stage and see all the hands in the air. I wrote it because I thought if I don't write it, I'm going to end up on the drink for the next 3 days or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Naturally, when everything fell into place and then I got a record deal and really snowballed into, you know, now being a touring musician and all that kind of stuff. Naturally, you do start thinking about, okay, well, I need to write songs that people are going to sing along to, and, you know, you want people to leave singing la 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 at the end of gigs and all that kind of stuff. So it's finding the balance, I think, of writing what you want to write. You know, I still pour my heart and soul into everything that I write. Still a lot of songs that are really personal. And then added to that, try and have a little bit of, you've got to have a good chorus, man. If you work on a chorus, and you can make it as catchy as you can, 9 times out of 10, somebody's going to leave singing it. Do you know what I mean? But I think the key is to not compromise what you're writing for in the first place, I think. I never got into writing and I never got into music because I wanted to see people with their hands in the air singing along. I got into music because if I didn't, I was going to be out sniffing glue. Do you know what I mean? So it's not losing that. I think it's not losing that. It's not losing the reason why you got into it in the first place. And then naturally, the better you get and the more you gig, the better a songwriter you're going to get. And you'll find out what your audience wants as well. Do you know what I mean? I know that if I went out on stage with a mandolin, my audience probably wouldn't like it because that's not, you know, kind of what they're there to see. If I walk out with an electric guitar and sing an anthem, you know, something like Where's My Family Gone, I know that that's going to go down better. So I think it's about knowing your audience as well. But all of that stuff takes time. It all takes time. The first few songs that I wrote were terrible. And that's after I got a record deal. All of my best songs were written out of, feeling bad or wanting to therapize myself, rather than I'm writing this song because I've got a gig next week. All my best songs come from somewhere else, I think.
And thank you for sharing that. And regular listeners will know that I do a lot of work in the world of mental health away from the podcast. And I was speaking to a counsellor who supports people in the arts a while ago, and he said that the majority of the people that he spends time with are people who are getting to their 30s or 40s who are songwriters or have been songwriters or performers, that's drifted away or dropped away because they had kids and had to pay bills and that type of thing, and actually don't need the therapy. Their therapy should have been through the thing that they were initially doing, which was writing and performing. Yeah. And it's a lot of his advice is, look, just go back and play some open mic nights or get back on the stage, you know, where you belong, which I think is which is super interesting. So I'm glad that you shared that.
I've interrupted you there. I do apologize, but it's interesting that he said that, because I'm not trying to say I'm a therapist by any means, of course I'm not. But, you know, I've done a few bits a couple of years ago with Mind and all that kind of stuff. And one of my big things was about, you know, having, what's the right word, man? It's the right, I know the word in my head, but I can't think of it.
It'll come.
It's almost like having an escape, you know, whether it be going to the football on a Saturday, or whether it be writing a song, or whether it be going to the boxing, or whether it be going on a run. You know, it was having that escape. And the people who haven't got something like that, something to just take them somewhere else, they're the ones that struggle the most, I think.
Have you ever heard there's a famous quote by Picasso, which was, all children are born artists, the challenge is to remain an artist as we grow older. And that's like a real that speaks a lot. And I know you're a very young man and you're going to be writing songs for generations, and people are going to be loving this stuff for a long time.
Fingers crossed, mate. I could be dead. Fingers crossed.
Tell us, you know, many songwriters listening to this will battle with when a song is finished. And what I mean by that is, there'll be songwriters right now that on their laptop, they'll have the name of the song, and then they'll say Finn, F-I-N, 11112, 11131. Yeah, yeah. And just like, you never, every time you listen back to it, you want to tweak it. And that sometimes can stop you from actually releasing stuff and being as creative in new projects that you could do in new songs. So what's your metric for when you go, okay, I'm not going to touch this anymore?
I don't know. I suppose you know when you know. I think if you keep on going back, you can always keep on going back to stuff. When you are right, when you see them files on people's computers and it's, you know, again, generic song title, I don't know, flip flop, you know, version 2, you know, 1.73 or whatever. You can always keep on coming back to stuff and think, oh, that snare drum needs turned down a little bit. And it's just, I think you've got to eventually just walk away from it. The best answer to this, though, I think, was in a Noel Gallagher interview when he was talking about what's the story he was talking about, and he said that if he hadn't knew how big the songs were going to get, he never would have finished them.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's that thing, if you don't know, some of the best songs in the world, there's imperfections on them all. Do you know what I mean? It's the imperfections that make them beautiful, and that, you know, that makes them human. I think in today's world, nowadays, it's very easy to put something through an AI computer and, you know, polish everything up. Things can be polished too much, man. Sometimes the impurities is what makes the song. Nice. I mean, obviously,
and do you delegate that decision to anyone else?
Finished before you put it out. Do you know what I mean? You don't really put it out any less than that.
80% is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's some interesting research around perfectionism, and what perfectionists are advised to do is stop when they get to 80%, because that remaining 20% is kind of like, does it actually exist? And it's kind of almost, you know, stopping you doing other stuff, which I think is interesting. Do you have, what's the relationship with, do you self-produce or do you have a producer? And if so, do you delegate that decision to someone else?
We did on the second. I got the first album, I really pushed to use a guy called Dave Eringer.
Oh, we've had him on the podcast.
Dude, man.
Yeah, he's amazing.
He's brilliant. He's a lovely guy. We're big Star Wars fans in our camp, right? So on day one of the recording, I bought him a proper lightsaber off the internet. It cost a fortune. So I came in with this. And I was like, there you go, Dave. Make me a number one album. But he's a dude. He's a great guy. So, yeah, obviously, but if you've had him on the podcast, you know, you know exactly who he is. So we had him. The second album, there was talk of me going in and kind of doing a little bit on my own. But I'd be lying to you if I said that I was qualified enough to go in there and do that. You know, I know roughly how my songs should sound. I'm still learning. I still get better. Every time I'm in a studio, I learn something new. Every time I'm writing, I learn something new. But I don't think I'm quite at that, you know, Noel Gallagher level of I can get into a studio and produce my own stuff yet. So a guy called Gareth Nuttall, who has worked with the label a few times, his name came up and it was like, yeah, I don't really know who he is. I don't really know what he's done. So let's go in. Let's do the total opposite. We wanted to do the total opposite of everything that we'd done on the first record. You know, the sad songs I wanted to make upbeat, the more beat songs I wanted to, you know, go a little bit psychedelic with. So going in with a producer that, absolutely no disrespect to him because he's a lovely bloke and we've made a brilliant record. He drinks more cups of tea than anybody I've ever met in my life. But I think going in with somebody that I'd never met, I didn't really know what music that he'd produced in the past. That worked wonders for me because it was like, I don't know what you're good at. You don't know what I'm good at. These are the songs. Let's see what we'll come up with. And I think it worked out brilliant.
And were there any techniques that he utilised to get the best out of you that you hadn't used before?
I don't think there was any techniques. There might have been a few ways of, you know, different strumming patterns and all that kind of stuff. And maybe, you know, picky stuff with the guitar that I hadn't tried. I will say this without, you know, blowing too much smoke up my arse. I am very good at knowing, you know, I can't sing without like, don't really want to come across as arrogant or anything like that, but I can't sing. So when I'm in the vocal booth and stuff, I know where my limits are. I know what I can push. I know where all that stuff. So the biggest thing for me in them kind of situations is just having a producer that trusts us. Dave massively trusted us. Dave really pushed us with my harmonies. It was just a case of, you know, being in there with like Gareth, and I'd kind of go, right, I've got two big ones in us, and he trusts us to do them, kind of thing. But I think definitely with the guitar playing, he's a brilliant guitarist. So yeah, he taught us a few different stuff that we could try on the tracks and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, in terms of the singing and all that, I've kind of got that nailed down, I think, dude.
Yeah, your voice sounds so, on the lead track, I made a note of it when I was listening to it yesterday. Your voice, particularly, there's a point where you hit this kind of big note, and you probably know the one I'm talking about, and you gravel, and it sounds like when you're a songwriter, you've gone up through the, you got your capo on, you go up through the, and it's like, where's the stretch? Okay, I can't quite go that far, but I'll go like a step down from that.
Yeah.
And your voice just sounds at absolute peak. It sounds so good, particularly in the last chorus. What's your memories of writing Love Is For Everyone?
I wrote it when I was in America with Louis. I played it. I can't remember the venue that I first played at, but I played it a few times on that tour. You know, it was just, we never had the band out there. It was just me and Rich, my keyboard player, was also the MD. Yeah, I kind of potted on with it. I think I might have started writing it the day before we flew, because I remember having a sheet of paper with like half a verse on when I was on the plane. Obviously, it's a decent flight, so I was trying to do a little bit there. And then I kind of chipped away with it every, you know, sort of every day. We were gigging every day, so I'd kind of try and give a little bit. And then I think I finished it by the end of the first week, and I think I was playing it in the set by the start of the second. It was like that quick. But, you know, I don't know what it is, because I must either be, you know, idiotic or, you know, incredibly brave to go out, because we were playing like Hollywood Bowl in the Greek Amphitheatre and, you know, Forest Hill Stadium. It just unbelievable, like bucket list venues we were ticking off kind of one after another, you know. And I don't know why I thought, you know, I'm here doing it acoustic with 15,000 people watching us. Let's just stick in a new song that I finished yesterday. But I've always kind of been that kid that just thinks, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? Some of the worst things that can happen in your life, they've already happened to me. So going on stage and playing a new song doesn't really bother us. And then I am going somewhere with this story, by the way. So then this song Lovers for Everyone started to pick up some attention around those fans. So when we came back, the album was written around that song. That's where the story was going. So the album was kind of written around something. So that was the first song that was written for the record. And obviously it's centered around love and all that kind of stuff. And it really shaped what that album was going to be, and obviously picked up a lot of fans and a lot of interest. So naturally that became the first single as well.
Nice. It's a banger. Tell us other songs that you're... Here's a question. What's the song you're most looking forward to people hearing that they haven't heard yet? So as of recording this, only that Love Is For Everyone and All Right has been released. Yeah. So there's probably, what, I don't know, eight or nine other songs. So what song have people not heard yet that you're most looking forward to them hearing or to playing live?
Yeah, there's 12, by the way. 12 songs in it. Oh, I've, nice. I've pushed the boat out with this record. There's a song called Standing By My Side. I know when you mentioned the long note in Love Is For Everyone, but that's the best vocal take I've ever done.
Nice.
I think that's the best song I've ever wrote, hands down. It's my absolute pride and joy, that tune. It's about someone really special, and it's a brilliant tune. But again, it was one of those things where, like, Gareth just trusted us to go in. I'd done the vocal take in one go. It's all the same take.
Nice.
And we knew it was going to be special from them. We got a beautiful orchestra to come in and play on it. So yeah, probably a song called Stand By My Side, I think.
And how did the orchestration come about? Did you hire someone to write a part for it, or did you hum any parts? Like, how did that, because it's such a key part in a lot of modern day music.
Yeah, you can kind of have an idea, you know, you can hum and half certain things, and it's very easy to go along certain guitar lines. But if you want to do it properly, you've got to really get a string arranger in. I'm definitely not articulate enough with words in general to come up with, you know, I want this to be whatever. Do you know what I mean? So we got somebody to come in and do it. You can kind of always have a bit of an idea, as I say. You can go along certain lines, certain guitar lines and stuff. And we've done that a few times. But yeah, we got a guy in. I can't remember his name, but he was a lovely guy. And he came in and done all the parts. Very reasonably priced, which, you know, is good in this economy. And yeah, the song's sound great. So yeah.
Nice. What's the best love song ever?
The best love song ever. I'm going to throw a bit of a curveball in because it's a really special one to me. I'm not sure if it'll be the best love song ever, but it's I love it. It's a song called Me and You by Jake Bugg.
Oh yeah,
which is a brilliant tune of his second record, I think it is. But yeah, that I've got that's quite special, that song for me. But anyway, not trying to get out, you know, nauseous on camera.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for sharing. I'll encourage listeners to go and check it out right now. Actually, well, after the interview, let's talk about your live performances. What do you personally need on stage as the vocalist and guitarist and front person of the band to feel really, really confident going on stage? You're obviously a confident guy, and you know you got the songs behind you. That's one thing. It's like, you know there's good quality stuff that you can be playing. But in regards to the sound check, and you talk about in-ear monitors and stuff like that, what's the common denominator for the ones where you go, yeah, I'm really going to enjoy myself tonight from the sound check perspective?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, you've got to have a good set of IEMs as well. It's no good going on stage with you could go on stage with one of the best, you know, monitor engineers in the world. If you've got poor IEMs, that kind of, you know, there's only so much you can do with them. So I really invested in some proper, you know, molds and, you know, proper packs and all that kind of stuff. And they do cost a fortune, but they pay for themselves. So that already makes a great difference. What do I have on? I have quite a bit of click in my ears, so I can stay in time. I have a lot of my guitar, a decent bit of my vocal, and then just a general mix of everyone else. I'm not too... You know, I speak to some people and they're like, you know, I'd like my bass at such and such dB, and this has got to be over here, and this needs pan to the left. I'm not that fussy with it, to be truthfully honest. The guy who does my ears, he always seems to do a good job with them. So, the room can help as well. You know, the room, sometimes, you know, taking one ear out and actually hearing the room a little bit. It's a funny one because you don't, you know, sometimes you have a terrible sound check. It's like when I used to play football, and it's like sometimes you'd have an awful warm-up. You'd have one of your worst warm-ups ever. The ball, I was a keeper, so the ball would be slipping through my hands and all sorts. And then you'd have one of the best games of your life, do you know what I mean? So I've had a few times where I've had a brilliant sound check, you know, taking 2 hours and just nailing it. And then you go on stage and, you know, someone's kicked an amp over and your mic stand snapped and all that kind of stuff. So as long as everything works, as long as all the lights come on the amps, you've got a chance of a good gig.
Nice. After being signed and, you know, starting doing those kind of first gigs and, you know, how successful the first album was, how do you think it impacted you in any way to start being recognized? Because again, 99% of musicians listening to this probably won't get the experiences or have had the experiences that you have, but are striving towards that. How does it change you, if at all? I know probably the cool answer is to go, oh, it doesn't change you, take it on in a stride. But like, is that the reality or even subconsciously?
Yeah. Anybody who says it, oh, I've never changed. Absolute crap. It is that answer of people wanting to be like, oh, you're so down to earth. I haven't turned into an arsehole at all. I still go and sit. I had a lock-in at the pub last night. That's why my eyes look like piss holes in the snow. I still see all my mates. I still see all my family. You know, if anybody, you know, last night I was playing darts all day last night with the old fellas in the pub. Do you know what I mean? It's not, I don't walk around like the big I am by any means, but it naturally changed because you start thinking that you're a bit successful. And then you start thinking, well, hang on, is that a bad thing? And of course it isn't a bad thing because I've worked hard. I've wrote all them. Nobody wrote those songs for me. Nobody sang them for us. So I should be proud of what I've achieved. And then you also get the imposter syndrome of it. It's of like where, like what you've just said, that, well, no, but there's people out there that are more deserving to achieve what you've achieved. So then naturally you start getting a little bit more reclusive. So it does change you, but it doesn't turn you into this, I'm a pop star. Sometimes it changes you for the negative because you don't think that you deserve what you've earned. Me personally, you know, I'd sit here now and tell you, you know, that there's times I've, you know, we've done 41 states in America. I'm not even the best singer in this street. Do you know what I mean? It's like, so what gave me that opportunity? Of course, I should take some credit for it and say that nobody was writing songs in this street. But naturally you think, well, you know, but there could have been. Or I could have wrote them for them and they could have had that dream. So it does change you, but it doesn't necessarily change you for the better or the worse. I get in my own head about it all the time, do you know what I mean? It's only when I do things like this that I, you know, when somebody asks you a question and you've got to sit back and you've got to reflect on kind of what you've done and what you've achieved. So I'm incredibly proud of what I've done, incredibly proud of it, but I'd be lying to you if I said that it hasn't changed us, but not turned us into that thing. Just maybe, you know, someone else is a bit more deserving of this, I think.
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I think it's, I think a lot of people want to do your job and there's only a certain amount of people who get it. So like, kudos to you for making that happen. One thing about imposter syndrome, I mean, you probably know this, but literally everyone's got it. And I know people who have been like in Grammy winning Hall of Famers bands who think at some point I'm going to be rumbled for not being able to do stuff to a certain standard that people probably expect me to. So like, everyone has imposter syndrome, every industry. So like, don't worry about that. That's
it's
just normal.
Mental. Honestly, I've had like mad little like brain farts where I'll just be sat on my own and I'll think I'm getting sued next week. And I don't know the way my mind works. Mm. But I've definitely ripped off something. Oh my god, I need to play Where's My Family Gone. That's ripped. I'm getting sued next week. My career's over and I'm going to prison. Do you know what I mean? It's like it is such a real thing. And for the level that I'm at, God knows how it feels. For people who are winning Brits and people who are nominated for awards and all that kind of stuff, that must just be, you know, mental. Do you know what I mean? I suppose the biggest thing, I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and that's the main thing. Like I say, imposter syndrome's real, all that other stuff's real, but I'm enjoying it and I'm pleased and I'm happy, and that's the main thing. I'm hungover as well, but that's by the by.
How was touring with Noel's band? So you did a High Flying Birds tour, is that right?
Yeah, we've done it. Done a few shows with him. I mean, Noel's a dude, obviously. If it wasn't for Noel, I wouldn't be doing this. He was the one that started this whole mad career, and I'll be forever grateful to him for it, of course. The shows were great. Where did we do? We've done a few over the years. I can't really remember. The last one we done was at Halifax Peace Hall, and that was pretty cool. We were the only support for that, so that was great. But yeah, they're class. We've done it. I've met them all individually. I've met them all together. Mike Rowe, who plays on his keyboard, he played on Where's My Family Gone. He also played on Memories, and he was going to come and play on the album. I don't think he could get up to the studio, but I've worked with him a few times. He's great. I was invited down for some convention thing at Gibson, and I bumped into Gem Archer, and that was the first time that I met him. He's a dude. I know you mentioned Russ. I met him in a bar in London. Mm-hmm. So I've met them all individually and then all together as well. So yeah, they're all great, man. They are really nice people.
You know, I said it's a 10-year anniversary of the podcast this year.
Yeah.
And you said, oh, you owe everything to Noel. There's one person I owe everything to that started this. The person who was on the first ever episode is Mikey Rowe.
Is it really?
Well, how weird,
I've mentioned his name, man. That's mad.
Very weird. And we hung out last year in Brighton, and I always say to him, like, that's, you know, if it hadn't been for you saying yes, we recorded it in Paris. Yeah. And then it just became a snowball from there, basically. Because he's
amazing.
So I didn't know he played on that. He's a brilliant player as well. Like,
he's
not underrated, but yeah, he's an incredible player. What are your highlights playing to that type of audience? Like, so they're obviously expecting, you know, Noel to come on, play a few High Flying Bird songs, and then play some massive hits. Like, does it get into your, like, how did your mindset change when you're playing a support slot to your own shows?
Well, your own shows, people are there to, you know, support, they'll be there to support the art, the first horns and the support acts and all that. But, you know, first and foremost, when they buy the tickets, they're there because they like your music. Do you know what I mean? So I suppose the pressure's off a little bit then, because you can just go and enjoy playing your songs. Mm. Supporting, I suppose it would be easy to get yourself wrapped up in the, you know, I need to pick the best 7 songs that I've got for the support slot, because, you know, this fucker's got Don't Look Back in Anger in his back catalogue, do you know what I mean? And Live Forever. He's going to pull them both out one after another. So I need to come up with an A game. So it'd be easy to do that. But I don't mind. I try to be a bit of a sponge, to be truthfully honest. I'll always watch who I'm supporting. I try and pick up as much as I can from them. Obviously, when I was first on tour with Louis, an incredible performer with a crowd in the palm of his hand. So I try to pick up a little bit of that showmanship from that. And then, you know, every time I watch Noel, just a cool fucker. And obviously, he can write an immense song. So again, trying to learn a little bit from that. I think performance-wise, I give it a little bit more maybes. I don't know if I'd be correct in saying that, but I think I do. But it's just to pick up new fans. That's what you got to do. Do you know what I mean? You've got to try and outperform the rest. I don't know. It's a different feeling doing support shows. I enjoy them both. As I say, there's less pressure doing a headline show. And obviously playing your songs, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't, you know, less fun. It's playing a headline show is what you always want to do. Do you know what I mean? Particularly in your hometown. When I come back and do a Newcastle hometown show, it's easily the best show of the year. Within the first 2 songs, being a support act, I suppose you've just got to really perform your ass off, really, and try and pick up as many of the artist's fans as you possibly can. Get it on all the socials and all that kind of stuff. That's the world we're living now. But like the Noel Gallagher Halifax gig, there was a guy there called Will who works with Aston Martin, who fell in love with my performance. And in turn, we're now working with Aston Martin Aramco and going to do a couple of Formula One stuff. So
nice.
It goes to show you never know who's in the crowd. You should always give it 110%. You know what I mean? Headline shows are fun, but, you know, supporting act shows, you don't know the crowd. You don't know the audience. You don't know who's going to be there. So
if you're happy to share it, if you can't, that's fine. But I know you said previously that one of the biggest things you learned when Noel invited you to his studio and to write him was around writing Middle Eights, and at that time you were writing very much verse chorus and wasn't sure where to go with Middle Eights. What specifically did he teach you? Was it a particular kind of pattern in regards to chord change to then progress that you can go back to the final chorus, or like what was it that he brought in? Was it the fact it was guitar solos you think he played on?
Not really, to be too honest. He didn't it was like, have you thought about writing more Middle Eights? And I was like, no. And I was like, well, you should. Like, right, how do I do that? He's like, figure it out for yourself.
Ah, fair enough.
You Geordie fucker, is what he said. So it's one of those things where you go away and you learn it yourself, do you know what I mean? And like the Middle Eight and Lovers for Everyone's arguably the best part of the song. You know that bit, I'm begging you, please. That bit. So again, it just goes to show, because I went into that studio thinking, I'm going to record with Noel Gallagher, this song must be up there with Bohemian Rhapsody. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And it didn't even have an instrumental break. So it's like, you can always learn. There's always things to learn. Like I'll pick up the guitar this afternoon and I'll probably learn a new chord or something like that. Or, you know, pick up a new whatever. But yeah, I learned a lot off Noel. A hell of a lot. It was a brilliant week. But yeah, there was no like, there was a little bit of, you know, try this and try that, but there was no, you know, this is the formula to do it. It was kind of go in, find your own way, you know.
And who played drums on it?
One of the Stacey's. I always get them mixed up.
Yes, Jeremy. That was Jeremy Stacey.
Would have been Jeremy.
Yeah.
Because Paul was engineering it. But I always get them mixed up.
Yeah.
But you were brilliant.
For everyone's benefit, they're twin brothers, yeah.
I know. Yeah. He was brilliant. It was like, I've never been more envious of someone else's job in my life, because he came in, I think he nailed it in about two takes. Noel got what old chicken burgers, if I remember rightly. We went upstairs, had some bass, and then he went to sleep for the rest of the day on the set upstairs. He'd done two drum takes and that was undone for the day. And I was like, bastard, do you know what I mean? I was like, I'd love that job.
He's a player, that guy's a player.
Oh, he's brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
Brilliant stuff. Here's a big question for you. If you were to find out the world was ending tomorrow, what would be your biggest regret musically that you've not got around to yet? What would you be like, I should have done that, or I could have done that, or what would be your big regret?
Maybe learn more about different instruments. I'd love to learn the piano. Really, really love to learn the piano. It's a different type of writing. Yeah, probably just, I'd say probably dedicate more time to other instruments. Do you know what I mean? I can play the guitar, but I'm not brilliant. I can sing, but I'm not brilliant. Maybe dedicate more time to become brilliant. I'll tell you what else. I want to do this in a few years. I've got a little side project in the back of my mind. For a band, which obviously I'll write for and I'll sing in, but yeah, I've got a little side hustle that I want to do at some point in my life. But yeah,
how is it different to what you're doing currently?
A little bit different. But I've got it in my head. We'd only do one tour, and I don't think we'd do any festival. I think we'd just do one tour, put an album out, and then let it die. And that would be it. Just something totally different.
What's stopping you playing the piano now?
I haven't got one.
Right, sponsors, get in touch.
Yeah, there you go.
In one interview I was listening to yesterday on the train, you said that some of the recordings from the first record weren't played to a click and others were, and obviously now you're playing to a click. How did that... I've gone through both those kind of two experiences, and for listeners' benefit, there are some very high-profile drummers in the world who still can't play to a click and aren't doing particular shows as a result of that. And that's fine. You know, sometimes that people, you know, it takes the feel out of it for you. So from your perspective, how did it change? Did you ever feel like playing to a click when you first started playing, like held you back in regards to the energy that you wanted to give, or actually just didn't work for you? Or did you find yourself just naturally sitting in with it?
Yeah, I couldn't play it to a click at all. I was terrible. I think most people are. When they first play again, it just goes back to what I was saying before about learning and constantly wanting to get better. Download a little metronome on your phone. It's the easiest thing to do to get good at playing to a click. The reason why we didn't play some of the songs on the first album to a click, Dave wanted to record a few songs completely live. So naturally, we'd speed up by the time it gets to the last chorus and all that kind of stuff. And then we didn't want to be restricted when we played those live. So what we do is sometimes we had a fluctuating click, which was a nightmare to play to.
Really?
And that takes some getting used to, I tell you, because, you know...
What, so it speeds up and slows down?
It speeds up and slows down at different points in the song. So that was really tough to get with. But again, it's about, you know, trusting Rich, my MD, and saying, right, if this will work, and you think we're all good enough to play to it, then I trust you, you've got that title, let's go and do it. And fair play to him, man, he was bang on, because when we'd come to do it, it was like, it looked like we'd been playing together for years. Because, you know, the band would speed up and then nobody would be looking at each other but would know when to slow down. And it looked to the naked eye like they must be brothers or something, because they're clearly you know, fucking telepathic, but it was literally like just that click going faster and slower. So that was a funny one. Everything on the next set and everything on the next album's to a click. We want to keep everything. I've always been keen on, you know, it's a show now. Do you know what I mean? It's not a £5 pub gig anymore. It's now, you know, people are spending their money. They want a show. They don't want to just see me dance around the stage like a lunatic and, you know, forget words and choruses. So I think if we put everything to a click, you know, where it's, you know, nigh on the same every night, we're maybe changing the songs around once or twice. I think that's better than gambling on the drummer playing too quick tonight or, you know, me playing too slow or what have you.
Big question, this one. How do you compartmentalise being bandmates? So being bandmates from friends. Because obviously you want to enjoy yourself while you're on tour and that type of thing, but you're a profession, as you say, you want, you know, this is no longer £5 pub gigs. Yeah. How do you compartmentalise and how do you give feedback to bandmates if, you know, it's not exactly what you want from them?
It's the worst thing in the world, having to get rid of your bandmates. It's awful. You know, anybody and everybody who's been in the band or been around the band, they're still part of my family. I still speak to them all. I love each and every one of them. But from my point of view, you've got to see it as a business now, unfortunately. And, you know, if somebody isn't pulling their weight and they have a couple of warnings and they still ain't pulling their weight. And I'm not saying that this has happened, by the way. I'm just, you know, this is an example. I've had people that come and go for various reasons. But this is just an example completely. People aren't pulling their weights, let's say. If they ain't pulling their weight, you know, that affects me making money and this is my job. And in a business, if someone ain't pulling their weight, they've got to go, unfortunately. It's never personal. Never, never personal. But it just is what it is. But added to that, they're all great and I love hanging around with them and I love being on the road with them. They're my family. They're my best friends. Love them all. We have a proper laugh. Like, it's not like we have a proper laugh. We've got this thing called Wine Club, which is basically just means we get hammered on wine every night. We've got we write stupid theme tunes and that. Like, we have a proper laugh. Like, it's like being away with five of your brothers. It's mint. So it's devastating when one of them decides to leave or when one of them's got to go. It's heartbreaking, but it's my business and it's my income and I've got to protect that, you know.
No, I mean the way you answered that, maybe even subconsciously, the fact that you said that, kind of giving, if there's people not pulling their weight, giving them a couple of warnings and then they're still like, that's just completely fair. And I think if you're communicating in that way, but we speak to a lot of musicians who are the other side of the fence, and sometimes, you know, artists aren't as forgiving. I mean, these are famous old, you know, examples, like James Brown used to famously fine people on the spot if they played the wrong note, that type of thing, which is the other extreme. So I think what you're describing is really fair, and I think most people would really appreciate that. What do you feel that you need from the rest of your band to feel really confident? Is it a case that you, like, they've just got their parts now down? Is it a case that they're communicating with you during the gig? Like, what is it that you want from your kind of stage left musicians?
Well, I mean, it's our show. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's not, I always say that it's not my show. It's my business and it's my name on the poster, but I always say it's our show. It's the merch man's show. It's the kid who's driving the van's show. You know, it's the sound guy's show. It's everybody's show. So everybody's got to muck in. For me to feel confident personally, you know, just have their parts nailed down. If anything goes wrong, you know, stop, you know, tell me or whatever. But added to that, they need to feel confident as well. And them feeling confident will be me, you know, on top form, voice well rested, know all the words, be prepared as well. You know, for the guy selling the merch to be confident, you know, he needs me at the end of the show to go, right, go and buy a t-shirt. So he's doing his job. You know, on my last tour, we had the guy who was driving the bus, War Dave, we'll call him. We're all dragging him into the lounge and stuff nearly every night, do you know what I mean? And having a proper laugh together. And I try to keep it like a family, man. So what they need from me is exactly what I need from them, I think. Just, you know your parts, be professional. And yeah, I suppose that's it.
How do you maintain kind of the raw emotion of a song that you've played once you've played it 1,000 times? So is there any way that you kind of manufacture, like I've done it in the past where like I will really, really think about the lyrics of a song that I've sung like 500 times in the past so that I can kind of almost get back into it if I'm feeling like a bit removed from that song because it's almost like you're doing it on autopilot. You know, there'll be songs that you could play on autopilot that you know people are going to absolutely love. So how do you kind of reconnect with a song that you've played with loads?
I'm not too sure. You know, I've never really found it a problem, if I'm being truthfully honest. Like, I can always put myself back in that place that I was when I first wrote it. Like, when I play Waiting for the Rain, I still go back to being that 16-year-old kid. Like, that was the first song I ever wrote. So I still remember sitting, you know, roughly where I'm sitting now. And writing that song. So I don't know, I find it quite easy to put myself back in those situations. We used to play a song called 4.5% a lot, which is, you know, about my dad, and it's really personal. And that got to a point where it was like, right, I'm losing more than, and I don't mean fans, I mean myself. I felt like I was losing more of myself than I was, you know, because again, yeah. that song's dead honest, and it was another song example of therapizing myself and all that kind of stuff. So it came to a point where I was like, right, lads, I'm not playing that anymore. And you know, it's such a personal one that they respected it. But yeah, certain songs, especially the more acoustic ones, where, you know, it's just me and a guitar, I find it quite easy to put myself back in that place or that position I was when I wrote it.
Nice. And let's explore a topic that we've done a lot. So we brought this question up when we did a live episode with Free of the 1975, and it's something that's been a theme for the last year or so on the podcast. I remember Ralph Roll from Chic was like, oh, wow, that's a heavy question. But I wonder if you can explore the topic of kind of internal versus external validation as an artist. And for our listeners who haven't kind of got their head around that yet, so internal validation is writing a piece of music or performing a piece of music or piece of art that you are satisfied when you are just personally satisfied with it, whereas external validation is wanting other people to say it's great. Yeah. So where are you? And we all kind of are on a different path with that. So where are you with that?
Well, like I said at the very start of this podcast, I got into this for internal validation. Do you know what I mean? I got into this to stop me from going out and, you know, going a little bit mad, to be truthfully honest. I still become that young kid when I'm writing. When I write a good song, as I've got a little bit older and as I'm a bit more mature, I play it to, you know, my little sister and my mom, and, you know, send it to Lee, my manager, and all that kind of stuff. And when they see it's good, I know it's good.
Yeah.
For some songs. And then other songs, like that Standing By My Side, for example, that I was mentioning, that, you know, I think it's the best song I've written. Bob Dylan could have rang me and said it was a terrible song and I would have said, you're wrong. Do you know what I mean? Because I believed that song was great. So I don't know. I think it depends on what kind of art I'm creating. I'd like to think I'm still very much, you know, that young kid who, you know, he's writing for himself. It's a really tough question, that.
Thanks. That's what I do. I mean, one of the things, so I don't think it's a problem at the moment, but one of the things someone in your pathway, if you continue to ascend the way you are, could get into the position of is being surrounded by yes people. And they're just like, oh, there's Andrew Christian. Do you know what I mean? And so you need to pick out some critical friends, which sounds like you already have, who can say, even if you're really big or, you know, you're you know, writing hit records, whatever it might be, they can say, no, this isn't up to scratch or this isn't so good.
Yeah,
I know that can be a bit of a problem. So that's something you probably need to keep in mind.
I suppose a good example then would have been when I was doing the second album. You don't go in with those 12 songs, you know, you go in with about 25 or whatever, and then you whittle it down. And there's about 5 or 6 songs that didn't make the album that I thought maybe could have. And it was Lee, Gareth and Mark at the record label who just said, you know what, these ones are better than them ones, you've got to trust me. So again, me trusting people who are employed to be around us and employed to look after us. I trust them. But yeah, it would have been very, very easy for them to just go, yeah, let's just keep Andrew happy and put them on. But then it would have been detrimental to the album as a whole because it wouldn't have been as good. But I'd like to think that I'm still happy with me writing a good song. The external validation's a bonus, I think. I think you've always got to, as a performer and as a musician, my job is to entertain other people. Do you know what I mean? But that doesn't mean that I shouldn't be happy myself when I'm writing my own stuff. Do you know what I mean? So if I can keep myself happy, and if I can sleep at night knowing that I've written a good song, then I'll be very, very happy with that. The external validation that comes later, that's the bonus, I think.
Nice.
I got myself out of that question there.
Nice. You talked about trusting people. We're going to wrap up soon, but there's a couple of last questions I really want to explore with you, which is, you talked about bringing in people to your circle of trust. And we had Alex from the Lathams on recently, and we explored this question, which is, imagine you're a band that are coming through now, or a lead singer that's coming through now, a performer, who's say in their early 20s, and things are happening for them, and they have to start bringing in other people to that kind of circle of trust that you have. What are the qualities you're looking for? Because there's been countless examples in the past of people doing that and being ripped off, you know, and sharks in the industry and that type of thing. But so what's your process to decide who you work with and who you don't, whether it's your social media person, whether it's, who's doing the merch, what are you looking for?
If I'm being truthfully honest, mate, I think it's trial and error. And it's awful as that is, because I've had people come into my team and it hasn't worked. It just hasn't worked. But you don't know, because, you know, you can't spend a few hours with somebody on the phone, which is what me and Lee have done in the past. And then you come away and you go, let's bring them on to sell the merch, or let's bring them on as a roadie or whatever. And then, you know, you see a different side of them after you spend 3, 4, 5 months on the road with them, you know? So it's a little bit of trial and error, unfortunately. I think anybody can give a good interview. If you're after the job and you've got to go meet the person who could give you the job, and you've only got an hour to impress them, you can do that. It's the few months later that they'll start to see through cracks. For them to come in, so like I say, it is trial and error. But for some of the traits that I'd be looking for, if you are just going to jump the gun and just go, right, we're just going to bring him in. Like, for instance, I got a drummer in America, a guy called Nick Savoni, who is an absolute dude and one of the best drummers I've ever seen. And I spoke to him on the phone for 20 minutes before I went up and done a show. And then I spent 6 weeks with him over in America. So that could have been disastrous, but that one worked. But he was polite. He was very grateful. He also offered a little bit of sacrifice as well. I don't mean like he chopped off a finger and nothing like that. But he was like, right, you know, he's flying into Nashville. I live in Boston. I tell you what, I'll drive over to Nashville. I pay for my own petrol. I bring my own drum kit. You know, you need showers in America. Let's go to a Planet Fitness where I can, you know, I can use my American details and get his old shower cords. So it was like, he's a polite kid, clearly very grateful. And also he doesn't want to just come and rip off. He's also, you know, he's putting his hand in his own pocket as well. Not saying that I'd just be looking for people that are going to pay their way. But I think someone being polite and grateful and offering up, you know, oh, well, I don't mind driving the van one weekend, or I'll do this for you. I think all that kind of stuff goes a long way, because it's obviously a very stressful business, and having somebody to take the load off. But the answer to your question, mate, it's trial and error, unfortunately.
So we're going to begin to wrap up. There's someone I want to ask you about, actually, who we haven't really spoken about too much on this podcast, but I've had lots of conversations with Matty Healy from 1975 about a particular artist that I know your dad was a fan of, right? Mm-hmm. And that is Damien Rice.
Yes. Right? How did you know that?
Do my research.
You've done your research, lad.
So we never really talked about Damien Rice on this podcast, but his first album, O, particularly, is just an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah.
Tell us about how Damien Rice factors into, or maybe factored into, you listening as you grew up.
Well, it was like, I'm from that old school thing of you always listen to what your mum and dad listen to. Do you know what I mean? So I was brought up on a cocktail of Oasis and, you know, The Jam and the Stone Roses and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, my dad had this real, you know, folky soul side to him, where he could just sit for hours and just be totally immersed in a world of finger picky, you know, really heartfelt music. One of those artists was Damien Rice, and it was something that stuck with me for quite a while. I became a big fan of Damien Rice. Yeah, he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. Like, you know, Cheers Darling and all that kind of stuff. They're fantastic songs.
Cheers Darling. I don't know, do you remember it has the percussion on there, which is done the chinking of the glasses? Yeah, so yeah, yeah, it's like course. People, and like that almost becomes the click track to the whole piece. It's really
I've even watched videos of how he plays it live. He plays it live with like the tracking stuff on, and you can hear this. It's so clever. Really? It's so clever because he doesn't use it. If I'll have to try and find the link and send it over, but he's got, there's a video of him playing it live on YouTube, and he doesn't have any ears in. He's just got his wedges, and he's drinking a bottle of wine. I think he does the full bottle of wine in, which is very impressive. And he's kind of doing all this and doing that, but he's just banging time, man. I find it mesmerizing. I think he's brilliant. Yeah. He's absolutely brilliant.
Good stuff. Last question. If you could change one thing in the music industry, what would it be?
Got to be fair pay, man. Got to be fair pay. Like, I know that's such a cop-out answer because everyone wants to make more money and all that. But, you know, the artists are the ones that are going out and entertaining people. When COVID comes, people look to the arts in the industries and all, you know, to be entertained. You go to the football and you sing songs. Do you know what I mean? It's always there. And they're the ones that make the most sacrifices. They're the ones that don't see their family or their friends for months and months, or maybe even years at a time. They're the ones that are constantly out of pocket. You know, people think that this whole industry is, you know, rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes rock and roll means you get paid in 8 cans of Red Stripe and then you're back in the van and on the next one, you know what I mean? So I think it's got to be I don't know whether it's more money getting put into it. It's a shame when you see all the small venues closing, because it just goes to show that even the struggling musicians, even they've now got nowhere to play. Do you know what I mean? So I'd have more money put into it. I'd just have more money put into it. It's very easy to say, what would you change? Oh, I'd change people slagging off bands and all that, but that's always going to be there. But there's people in the industry that are making a hell of a lot more money than the artists and doing a hell of a lot less work. So yeah, I'd change that.
Great. So what's the plan for the rest of the year? So obviously album comes out. Tour, tell us about what the plans are for the rest of the year.
Yeah, so the album comes out on the 2nd of May. I go on tour towards the end of May, I think, about a week after the album, somewhere around then. So we're doing UK. By the time that this, when does this podcast come out?
Around the 27th of April is coming out.
27th of April. So from then, my American tour has actually been announced at 6 o'clock tonight, which is great. We go back into Europe as well. I imagine Europe will be announced by the time this comes out as well. I think it will anyway. We got a couple of festivals, and we've got something big at the end of the year in Newcastle. I can't say too much about that, but there was a lot of people that were obviously disappointed that I haven't got a Newcastle show on the tour. We're going to do a Come Together Festival with Robbie Williams. I think it's 35,000 people in Exhibition Park. So it's going to be absolutely amazing. But what I will say, you know, we are doing something in Newcastle. Don't be too disheartened just yet. And then obviously I'll be going to record another album as well. Hopefully, you know, I want to keep on building. We've had a few months off the start of this year just to kind of, you know, work on other things. I've got a kind of IPA which will be out by the time this comes out, so you know they'll be available online, help promote the album and all that kind of stuff.
Great.
So, obviously working with Aston Martin as well. So, we're putting my fingers in a few different pies and all that kind of stuff. But it's going to be a busy year. And I'm excited to get it started, mate. Yeah, as I say, rehearsals start in April. And then, we're ready to go after that.
Well, listen, thanks for your candor and your wisdom and your insight and your vulnerability and sharing your processes. Good luck with the new album. I hope it goes really well. You know, tour sounds fantastic. You know, you're writing some songs that mean a lot to a lot of people, and you know, please continue to do that. Make sure we get on the piano, start learning the piano. We'll get you back on the podcast in a couple of years' time when you've got an album full of piano ballads as well.
Yeah, I'll hold it up, mate.
Yeah, nice one. All right, thanks for being such a great guest on the Stage Podcast.
Thank you very much, mate. All the best. Cheers.
Cheers.